Hi, Coral. You are asking me some questions, and we are now to question two. Question one was about we can't know what we don't know. So how would you like to formulate question two?
So given that we can't know what we don't know until we do, and then we do, but even then, I'd like to recall the third statement in the Delphic Oracle's chamber. Surety breeds calamity. You know, so if you think you know, you can create even a worse mess. So then, if it's all wrong anyhow, if the science has been usurped or, manipulated for a specific profit or control, then how do we deal with this?
I think the answer lies neatly in both tetrionics and the work of Bert Vervain. And as I discovered over the years since I got to know Kelvin and tetrionics, essentially I find that that's the model which suits all purposes, because once you understand that model, you can recognize it everywhere else. So when I juxtapose them, then on the one hand, tetrionic says that we have a quantum which moves and then traces a trail which has a magnetic wake, but actually you don't know if it's plus or minus until you in a way know what your polarity is and all of that. So that model is two-sided. It works for the plus, it works for the minus, and then in the science of life, you can then simply take that one step further and say, well, the possibility to operate freedom of choice is that by our consciousness within our body, we are able to flip that quantum. So we can go from a plus charge to a minus charge or the other way around. But as a result, the interface in which that quantum exists will go from a plus charge to a minus charge or the other way around, because there would be a charge neutrality at some point, and then one quantum flip can change that. So with that perspective, connecting it to the previous exploration, that we don't know what the foundation of the universe is. In terms of tetrionics, we can say that there is a foundation of the universe in moving charges and them creating this quantum dynamic. And tetrionics then describes beautifully how from that level up you can rediscover everything science has discovered, plus correct 400 plus errors or misconceptions or misperceptions on the way. Because suddenly there is an integrative mode perspective by which you can see why people came to that other kind of conclusion, because simply they couldn't look further.
Which conclusion, though?
Would you whichever. So in science, there are all kind of conclusions which were taken on the basis of what they could see, but then they try to conclude something about what they could not see. The quantum, of course, was an example of that. Electric charges was another example of that. So in electronics, they always say that the protons are moving, while actually it was discovered quite soon after that the electrons that are doing the moving.
Okay.
And so you can only see that something was wrong at the moment that you can change to a larger, more encompassing, more integrative perspective. But that we already covered in question one. That when you go to the largest, the greatest, and most encompassing perspective, then you see that everything we know is suspended in what we can best call the ignorance. And the classical traditions, they called it the void. In Dhammapada, they call it the cloud of unknowing, or the unknowables. So having already discussed that we don't know, then we need to try to make sense of what we do know. But as mentioned before, if you do not know and you come to a conclusion, then one moment later, you might discover that there is something else to discover, and whatever you thought you knew is wrong. Electrolytics, they said that the plus charges move. No, it's not like that. It's the minus charges that move. And they didn't correct that. Things like that need to be corrected.
So you're addressing something like the educational system, or at least a context where this information can even be known. What is known?
Absolutely. And more than that, it's the capacity for individual thinking. Because an educational system is, say, collective system. And most of that I described a long time ago in a paper called Scientific Consensus, which basically is about if you go into the unknown, which we talked about last time, then say you go into the jungle and you discover a bird with many colors, beautiful, you take it along, and then that's the discovery of the unknown. Then you meet up with somebody at the edge of the forest and say, well, what's this? So I don't know what it is. And let's give it a name. So let's call it the paradise bird. And so then the two of them go to the market, phase three of the cognition processing. They bring it to market, and at the market people say, well, this is wonderful. Can I rent it? Can I buy it? Or can I just look at it? And then somebody takes it along and comes back a bit later and say, do I need to put salt with this? So that last bit is where science slaughters the reality that we have. I talked about that previous time. That's where science is shelved. But it is that process from unknown to touching on the knowing, to making that transition into the connection where we do know things, to then file it into what we do know, which is essentially what we then see reflected in our sensory system. At the surface of the body we have these sensory cells. They are in contact with the, for us, unknowable, and we don't know what happens out there, for the simple reason that we are not in touch with that. It is in touch with us. We have all these vibrations of different kinds connecting up to our sensory system. Then sensory cells selectively discharge when they are triggered by some of those vibrations. That discharge in the point of the cell, actually in mathematics, that's what they call them, the Dirac pulse. That is relayed through the neuron as a Fourier code. That is then going into the neural plexus.
I didn't get that word. Would you state that again?
It is a Fourier code, Fourier. French mathematician who realized that we can organize things in time.
Okay.
And then goes to the third level, which is that of the neural plexus, where neurons weave together in a little tapestry. And physics then describes what happens there as a moiré array. That is where you, if you have two T-sieves on top of each other, you can see that larger and smaller patterns come out of that. They actually use that if they want to see how a bridge weighs down when it is loaded with trucks. Because you can then see how the one grid displaces with respect to the other. You can amplify. And so in our neural system, things like that happen. The retina in the eye is an example of that. And then the information goes into the brain, where it builds up to a hologram. The hologram is what we call the reality. And that is what science refers to. But what science should be acknowledging is that whatever they call reality is the consequence of a realization. And that what they call reality is worthless if you do not include the realization. So that's the topic of the question today. If you don't know, then how do you deal with that? If at the bottom of everything there's this gap of ignorance, How do you deal with that? If at a quantum level you actually don't know if it is a plus or a minus side of the quantum that you're dealing with, then how you deal with that? It's a bit like the song of Leonard Cohen. There is a crack in reality because there is a crack in the difference between reality and realization. And that is where the work of Bert Vervain comes in, because in his approach, he says that the body knows about that. The body deals with that crack in reality realization.
All the time.
No. So you described it earlier as certainty is the foundation of calamity. And this is also what psychiatrists then use as their motto, which they call reality testing or lack of reality testing. And it is intriguing that in psychiatry, just as in science, there is an immense lack of reality testing. For the simple reason that, of course, you cannot test the reality because the other side of the equation is always the unknown. And you can see that in cell replication, which is actually the foundation of this finding of Bert Vervain of how the body heals the gap all the time. And actually his definition of health is that there must be a balance between the forward feed forward and the feedback loop in the cell communication. In the Oracle of Delphi, you would say that the projection and the perception needs to match. You only project like the narcissist and the other idiots do, idiots comes from the word idios. They are self-referential. Mm-hmm. And the aliots, the alios, the other referential, is the counterpart of that. So idiots and aliots, they need to meet up. The projection and the perception needs to meet up in the way that the feed forward and the feedback needs to meet up. So that dynamic of weaving the web of reality by connecting reality and realization, in the way I look at it, it is most easily understood when you look at the first cell in our body, because at that level you can see that the first cell divides, and I keep on repeating that again and again, that in that dynamic of cell replication, you see that the materials dissolve, the molecules evaporate, the atoms discharge, and then in phase space suddenly something happens outside of our perception, outside of our capability to understand, in the subatomic realm where there is nothing. Then in that subatomic realm suddenly something happens and two cells bounce back out of that dynamic. And connecting back to the work of Lawrence Edwards, who in his book The Vortex of Life already described that if you turn a line inside out on itself, have the line go through a point on that line, then it will trace the shape of a vortex, and it will have the counterform of a torus and an egg associated with it. So when traditional cultures talk about the cosmic egg as a source of creation, that fully ties in with what Lawrence Edwards then describes as this vortex, which fully ties in with the examples of the world ring, Ouroboros, which is the torus shape. So
all
of these are equivalent models, and they actually fit into each other. And once you realize that, then it is simple to understand that the vortex actually gives more information about what happens than the egg or the torus.
Well, and it does give that serpentine image, because while you were talking, I was recalling the countless times I have found snake skins and even witnessed the shedding of the skin, where what was inside is now outside, and it leaves an old trail of its former, and it is in that same torus momentum. It needs something tight to pull against, and so it usually finds an opening. And I could see very clearly the serpentine quality and the egg, and they're interrelated, obviously. So thanks for illustrating that so well. I could see it as a hologram of a snake inside out, turning itself inside out.
Yeah, with that in mind, you can see that the torus is actually also how everything connects to its counterpart, and also that the Möbius loop, which is also seen in the figure 8 or the Lemnis gate, the infinity sign. Yeah. Essentially, if you have a rubber band, which is a ring, and you sort of rotate one side of it, it forms a figure 8, a Lemnis gate. And that is also the Möbius loop, and that Möbius loop is like, say, the egg on the one side of the vortex and the egg on the other side of the vortex interconnected, and it is in that way that the food chain outside of us and the food chain inside of us are interconnected. Again, it is that understanding that there needs to be a gap that needs to be bridged somehow, and the approach of Bert Verveen, it is the feed-forward and the feed-back loop that needs to match up. In the approach of tetrionics, it is the one side and the other side of the tetrionic quantum that meet up. And in tetrionics, the gap between the two is the capacity that you flip it over, which in science of life is the foundation of freedom of choice. And in the story of Bert Verveen, it is in that zero point where the feed forward needs to connect back to the feedback, and the origin of that lies in this dynamic of cell replication. So we came to that understanding that cell replication can be modeled by a vortex or an egg or a torus, for the simple reason that when you look at the dynamic of the cell replication at the 3D material, then goes to a 2D molecular, say, ring current that goes to the one-dimensional electron leap in the atom, and that goes then down to the zero-dimensional phase change, which is described so well by tetrionics as the tetrionic quantum.
Hang on a second there, Otto. Hang on. The signal skipped so that what you were saying was actually lost in that blip. Okay. Just the last bit.
Okay. So the cell replication can be understood or imagined as a vortex movement. A vortex, think of a bathtub. You have the bathtub full with water. You pull the plug, and then the volume of water, which is three-dimensional, from the surface of the water, which is two-dimensional, flows through that funnel in the streamline in that funnel, which is one-dimensional, through the drain, the sinkhole of the tub, which is zero-dimensional. So it is that shape which then is depicted by Lawrence Edwards as the shape which goes from one side to the other. And it is also in that way that we can see that we can go from one side of the boundary to the other. So the vortex, which is on the side of the bathtub, on the other side becomes the vortex which through the drain and through the municipal sewer system goes back to the ocean. And in that same way, if you have a black hole in the universe anywhere, yeah, then there is this vortex dynamic, at least that's the model that Albert Einstein used and that many people then copied.
And called a wormhole, or is that something else?
Yeah, essentially that's a vortex. So the wormhole is a vortex, and it's called a wormhole because when they talk about the black hole, they ignore that the other side of the black hole is a white source. But if things disappear on the one side, then they reappear on the other side. So that is then where we are in a way reconciling our stupidity of not being able to know anything by being able to know the edge of things. And actually, that is where we then see that even if we do not know everything, then we can get to know everything by finding out the edge of what we know and taking it one step further. And so the answer to the second question essentially lies there, that we need to go up to this boundary, same as the cell when it divides and material goes to molecular, goes to atomic, and then goes into phase space. And then even though we do not see what happened in phase space, we see the result of it. So in a way, and tetrionics makes that very explicit, tetrionics says, it's only the quantum field that can form and move matter. So in that sense, the physical reality has been formed and has been moved by the quantum field dynamic. So if you see any form in the physical, and you see the motion of that form in the physical, then it is a bit as if you look into a Wilson cloud chamber of physics, which is basically they use the same principle as when you have condensation trails behind an airplane, so that you can see where the airplane is, because condensation forms in the wake of the airplane. Clouds form in the same way. So when clouds forms, you know that there is either a current or a temperature difference, or there are dust particles as a result of which the cloud can form. So physics realize that and use this critical temperature and critical humidity concentration to create a vapor room in which the movement of any atomic particle will trail a trace of condensation vapor, same as behind the aeroplane. So that is how physics started to look into atomic particles. But if you look at it at a larger scale, then you can understand that everything you see, everything that is material, is in a way a condensation trail of things which have materialized, because the quantum field arranged that. The quantum field did that. In the past, they would have used the term God. And as the Hebrew culture says, well, you cannot really use that word because you can't explain anything with it. But once you start explaining it, you start to understand it. And you come back to what I mentioned the other time. God is then the generator, operator, and destroyer of, say, a cloud in the vapor trail, or a wave on the ocean, or anything material in this reality. So the generation, operation, and destruction of anything material takes place at the edge of the for us unknowable unknown. But as we can see in the cell replication dynamic, although we cannot see what happens in phase space, in a way we can look in the rear view mirror and see the consequence of it. So by seeing that a vortex implodes and comes back as a double vortex, then we can see that we now have a kind of witness, a kind of tuning fork. Actually, the symbol of Neptune and the symbol of Shiva and the symbol of the devil is the trident. Because it represents the capacity to stick the middle tooth in the edge of realities, and then with the other two prongs you can then have it on the other side, and then you can swirl it. You can create a vortex between the two, and out of that vortex you get these Mandelbrot images of the fractals of things convoluting, involuting on themselves. You can see enormous complexities arise, for the simple reason that what you could not see has now interconnected with what you can see. And then by swirling it in what you can see the effect of what you cannot see. So the Chinese Yi Qing describes that as the yin and the yang. Again, you can replace the one by the visible and the invisible. Or you can also call it the closed system or the open system. You can also call it material and immaterial. I often call it physics versus phasics. A phase space is where nothing particular is present. physics is where you have the particles, but you can only understand physics if you include the answer to the question number one, that there is something which we cannot see which actually produced all of that. So even though we are ignorant about what is outside of the universe that we live in, even if we cannot know and do not have access to the subatomic, we can see the effect of it in everything that is around us and also what is within us. And yep. That is also the reason why we cannot understand it, we cannot explain it, we cannot talk about it. We can talk about our body, we can talk about our physiology, we can talk about the electromagnetic currents and the electromagnetic charges in neurons and hormones and everywhere else in the body, but the radio information field, the quantum field itself, we cannot talk about because we cannot perceive it, because that is what forms us. So from the side of what we are, we as the puppets cannot pull the string of the puppeteer and say, well, now we can understand how we puppeteer, because the other side of that string is still in that unknowable unknown. And when you look at the development of science, you can see that they actually discovered all of this. At first, science tried to resolve this enigma, the mystery of mysteries, of the unknowable, by simply saying that they were outsider observers. Right. And it's a bit like a baby stage of cognitive development. Because then once they understood something, they say, well, this is applicable to everything. Just like a baby says, I now understand this, and this is how the universe works. So classical science is a baby mindset of cognitive development, because what you see in classical science is only the material stuff. You can see matter move, but you cannot see why it moves. You can see that matter is formed, but you cannot see what forms the matter. And so at some point they realized that they were stuck. Alchemists already had pushed them a lot further, but they later on tried to wipe that under the table, which is a bit strange because alchemy still stands upright and firm. It's now called system theory, cybernetics, radio circuit diagrams, and four-dimensional dynamic logic. But classical science said, well, okay, we don't understand it, so it cannot exist. And just as a sideline, you have these people who then say, if we don't understand it, this is unscientific. Just like you have these religious fundamentalists who say, if it's not in our book, then it is not true.
Yeah.
And so that's the baby level of cognitive development. You do not know what you do not know, and you don't even acknowledge that you do not know. Then came Albert Einstein and said, well, actually, we do know quite a while already that matter is actually composed of molecules, but can we now get an idea of what happens at that level of molecules? So he took some grass seeds, put it on water, and looked at the movement of the grass seeds on water. And it was a lucky choice because water has very interesting electromagnetic potentials and capacities, properties.
Yeah.
And grass seeds also have electromagnetic charge field around them, as Robert Becker later discovered for many other purposes, animals and beings as well. And so when Albert Einstein was looking at these grass seeds, he could actually see the movement of these electromagnetic fields. Faraday did it in a different way, and then Maxwell described that as the equations for electromagnetism. But when Albert Einstein was looking at this, he had an idea of how he could describe and model the Brownian movement of molecules, the Zitterbewegung, as he called it. So suddenly, classical science was exit, because it was now understood that everything material is formed from the molecular. And then the relativity theory basically tried to look into these time cycles, which you see in the electron currents in the molecules. and that these have different rates of vibrations. And then when you compare them, you can actually try to understand why there is a difference in speed between the one level and the other, because there's a difference between electron circulation between one model and the other. And then using the information of Lorentz, the Lorentz transformation, you can then say, well, if you have a point in a circle, any ring in that circle between the point and the circle will have a frequency which is larger than the point and smaller than the edge. And in that way, it became possible to describe the edge of it by extending the circle to as far as you can get. And basically, that was the answer to question one. Then Einstein realized, well, actually, you cannot say anything about what happens at the edge. So that's where he said, that's the speed of light, and we don't know anything beyond that. But everything within that, we can now say it is relative between zero and, let's call the other one, not one, but infinite. And then we have the theory of relativity to explain most of those dynamics. So that was fun. And then it turned out that the material suddenly became molecular, and that the universal validity of classical science had been replaced by an event horizon, a limitation on the application of science. So from babyhood it went to childhood. There was now a limitation to what was understandable and knowable. And there was also the understanding that we are not observers, but we are reacting to what happens. We are sort of part of it, but we don't see the other part of it. So classical science is outsider. Relativity theory is reacting with, in contact with the edge, so to say. And then came Max Planck, who looked at the atoms and said, well, when we measure what happens in the atoms, funny, what happens, honey, because suddenly we have this electron leap, but they always come in specific measured jumps. So he discovered that there was something called the electron orbits. Now, the model was wrong, but it got a lot further than where anybody else had been. So he said, okay, we now must assume that there are atomic orbits, and that electrons go from one orbit to the other, and lo and behold, we have something that pushes the electrons from one level to the other, and that is, say, the electron leap. So in a way, he was recapitulating what Einstein had said with this circle within the edge framing circle, but Max Planck looked at it differently and said, well, actually, it goes from one circle to one larger, but it can also go from one circle to one smaller. So then suddenly, he didn't have to deal with this, there is an edge to reality, because he simply said, let's not have a point in the middle, a circle at the edge, and call that infinity, and then the circle somewhere in between the two, and let's call that velocity or whatever. He basically said, well, if you have one circle, and you have another circle, and you put a next circle to it, so he went from, say, two circles to three circles, then you can go one circle inward and one circle outward, a quantum leap inward, a quantum leap outward, and lo and behold, we can actually jump outside of that circle. So probability theory was the next step up. It was based on the electron leap in the atoms, and it no longer was stuck at the speed of light, for the simple reason that it could scale things, and it was no longer caught in that limitation, but it was actually on the edge of things, and realized that on the edge of things you can go one way and the other. So coming back to question one, you cannot know what is going on at the far edge, but if you get close to it and you can compare one step ahead with one step behind, then you can get a better impression of what the difference is. So in quantum mechanics, a probability theory, then the outsider, which had already became a reactor, became an interactor. that, of course, was also where everybody then realized, we got it wrong. Let's come together in Copenhagen and sort things out. Because on the one hand, we know that everything is electromagnetic. On the other hand, we know that we are electromagnetic. So we know that we are not outsiders. We must be interactors. And we know that things are not particular because everything seems to be, turns out to be, electromagnetic. So happily they went off to the conference and came back and said, you know what, we're just going to continue pretending that we are outsiders, and we're just going to continue pretending that everything is particular, and we just leave it at that. That was an enormous setback for the development of science, because they had already shown that classical science deals with the materials, relativity theory deals with the moleculars, quantum mechanics, probability theory deals with the atomics. But now we needed to go into that unknown, where there's nothing tangible anymore. That was the domain of question one. So they got stuck. And when you look into the dynamic of cell replication, that's where you get stuck. But in a way, that is where physics operates as well, when they use its Wilson cloud chamber and look at the invisible and make it visible at this edge between condensation and not in a cloud chamber. And in that way, we can then see that when a cell implodes, this vortex dynamic of three-dimensional material, two-dimensional molecular, one-dimensional atomic to the zero-dimensional phase change in phase space, then by the way it comes back, we can see that there is a mirroring kind of effect taking place, which is, by the way, very similar to the principle of dynamics of laser. In laser you have a spark, you put a mirror, and then you can capture a mirror, and put another mirror, you can have two mirrors, and as a result you can have from the spark a wavelength one way, another wavelength the other way, but a double wavelength both ways. And as a result, from that spark in the middle, you can have half a wave, one wavelength, say down, and on the other side, one wavelength going up. So at the moment that you have two mirrors around the spark, you actually get the higher harmonic. You don't just have the wave from the spark to the mirror on one side and the mirror on the other side, but you also have the wave between one mirror and the other, which is double the length. So suddenly, and Einstein forgot about that, or ignored all that, you can see that if you have a light wave, it is not just that you have a wave going up and down, one after the other, as a wave field on an ocean, but there are wave harmonics. So when Tetrionics looked at that, it became clear that whenever you have a light beam, you not only have the waves one after the other, but you also have the twice as long waves and the three times as long wave. In fact, you have a wave as long as the beginning point and the end point. And as Tetrionics says, that means that these waves are actually phase locked, because all of these waves harmonics are in there. And the wave as a whole is one wavelength. But if you have a wave which is one wavelength, then the one side and the other side are actually directly connected. That's called the Tesla wave. And Einstein didn't look at that. So he said, well, when the wave propagates in space at the speed of light, then it needs to project the next wave from the leading wave, and that we cannot see how that happens. So he said, okay, let's skip that. But once you add all of these wave harmonics, you can see that every wave node is also the wave node of all these harmonics, and all these harmonics in a wave, the waves already stretch out and bring out coherence in the space ahead of them, and then can build up the next wave and the next wave and the next wave. Because the wave can then extend in that way, and that's what Tetrionics also says. The beginning wave and the end wave are in direct contact. So in your body when you are in your body, however old you are, around the body there is a light field which is as far extended in light years, because there is a radiative field around everything. And actually it's not just your age that extends into the light domain in that way as a Tesla wave, but actually your light field is 5 billion years old, because that is where material started to form as the basis of life. So once you see that and connect that to what the cell does, when the first cell divides, it is the same as a spark getting a mirror. So you have this cell, and then it implodes on itself with this vortex. It bounces on this extremely hard edge of reality, the unknowable unknown. And then when it bounces back, suddenly there's two cells. Okay, there's a bit of physics that you need to then understand that these two cells actually form a Cooper pair, which means that if you afflict the one, then you also afflict the other. And they're not separate cells. Let me put it differently. The implosion of the vortex of cell replication bounces back, but in a way the other side of the vortex is built into material space. So that's the essence of Cooper pair particles or Cooper pair cells. Suddenly you see the two sides of the vortex in the same material realm. But of course, if you want to have the preservation of momentum, one of these fundamental physical laws, then if you have a cell with a cell cycle, which rotates at a specific speed in a specific direction and all that, then at the moment that you have two cells, you have two cell cycles, but that means that there is a symmetry break, that there is something else is needed to restore the rotation which you had before that, which requires the introduction of an extra cycle. So then with the three cycles, you can have the same orientation or rotation again as you had before. But that third cycle is what Bert Verveen then understands as the feed-forward and feedback loop. And actually, at that feed-forward and feedback loop, had the projection and the perception, is what keeps the cells in unity. So in that way, you then have a combination of the story of Einstein, which says everything is circles, and you have the story of Max Planck, which says but there is a leap between them. And that is what you then see, that when you have these two cells next to each other, Cooper pair cells connected by this feed forward and feedback loop, which keeps the units in unity, then the feed forward loop from one cell to the other creates or continues as the feedback loop from the other cell to the first. But in a way, that feed forward loop is like the half wave between the spark and the mirror, and the feedback loop is the other part of the wave between the spark and the other mirror. And so these cells in a way mirror each other, so they are each other's laser device. So when you look at these feed forward and feedback loops, you can see that the cells are in that way combining the feed forward loop from the one cell to the other, from the other cell back to the one. But they mutually do that. They mirror each other. So while you have the feed forward cell going from one to the other, there's also the feed forward from the other to the one. So you have two feed forward and two feedback cycles, which seemingly overlap, which seemingly seem to be the same. And that is where you can then see that there is a holographic principle which is then started, initiated, and each cell is in this way the spark gap to attune these feed-forward and feedback loops. And in that manner, and Tetrionics has a beautiful description for that too, you can see that these cells can calibrate each other, and together they, this is again this principle of the torus, in a way you can sort of in your mind's eye see that these cells are like a cross-section of a torus, taking place in face space, and that in this tortoise you see the continuity of this first cell, and now not as an egg but as a and not as a vortex but as a tortoise, and then that process keeps on going on and on and on. So these cells divide again and again and again, and every time that cell division decision connects back to phase space in a zero point, the vortex implodes in itself, folds back on itself, creates a double vortex, which we then see as a cell pair, a Cooper pair. And then out of that Cooper pair, they are intrinsically connected by this feed-forward feedback loop, which keeps the units in unity. And so when your first cell then unfold, 10, 15, 20, 100 years later, these cells are still coherent because there is a very powerful integrating dynamic, which medicine always ignores, which traditional medicine always acknowledges. And it is that electromagnetic field dynamic where all of these phase loops, all these feed forward and feedback loops, are interconnected. And as Bert Vervaen then says, these feed forward and feedback loops are actually where the continuity is maintained. So in his approach, health is defined by the continued coherence of these feed forward and feedback loops. Remember that every cell is a tuning space between the one and the other. And so if something can go wrong, and this is what I described in the paper called The Equation of Health, then you can see that these cells will reflect this influence in what they do, for the simple reason, and that's the story of the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden talks about you have the garden, you have the tree in the garden, you have the snake in the garden, and you have the apple in the garden. So if you look at it in the simple way, you have the cell, which is the Garden of Eden. Then you have the tree of life, which is the decision division tree of that cell unfolding as a fractal, creating the whole body. But then all of these feed forward and feedback loops are the serpents, the Ouroboros, the preservers of continuity, the guardians of the old wisdom in that whole system. But then, as it is a hologram, these cycles interlock and interface with each other and form a large hologram. And then they create one of the shapes which is connected to that is this implosion system of the vortex turning inside out and forming the universe, which we also see in the Earth with the magnetic field, which has the shape of an apple. So then we can see that the point, the line, the plane, and the volume, the seed, the division decision tree, the fractal by which this first cell unfolded, all of these feed forward and feedback loops which interlock and interlink, and then finally the hologram, the bio hologram which is created out of that, they all have their fourfold, four-dimensional coherence. But if your body bumps into something, then the apple, the shielding shape around it, might get a bump, and it might need to reorganize things. So you bump somewhere, some cells get hurt, they need to be reset, the system falls back to the earlier phase of development, the pus, which is actually blood serum, comes in, the splinter or the traumatic experience is sealed into that. And then the body starts to rebuild it. So whatever happens in the body, it goes feet forward and feet back. And in what it does, it will always go back from wherever it is now, back to that first cell. Because that is the hologram, that is the source of the hologram, that is the origin of the hologram, and that's the pattern of unfolding. We can equally call it the soul, by which the body as a whole is connected to this first cell, even if the first cell is no longer there. And with Henk Coy, we elaborated how that works. Because if you have a cell and then it divides, you have two cells, but every cell has its cell cycle, which is a frequency. two cells have two frequencies, two tones. When you have two tones, you will get a ground tone and an overtone. The ground tone is what connects them. The overtone is what distinguishes them. So at the moment that you have 30 trillion cells in your body, it is a full symphony of frequencies interlocked and interlinked with overtones and undertones. And that is what forms this biohologram, which we then know as our body. As a story in itself, that you can then see that from the light field, which is the information system, the light field will then lead to different attunements of these waves and wavelengths and wave envelopes. The body as a whole, as a hologram, is a soliton. That's a simple fundamental physical principle. You have waves, and then you can extend them. That forms a wave train. In the wave train, you can have wave envelopes. And if the system as a whole is one wave, because it is a wave envelope, then that's called a soliton. That's a wave which can maintain itself. Maturana Varela called it autopoiesis. It can self-replicate. And Peter Rowlands then has the whole mathematics for that and shows that that's what happens at the DNA level. But essentially, that's also the laser principle. A DNA also is a laser principle. So our body as a whole is composed of that. And when our body adapts in the environment, it can bump into the hologram, and then it needs to set back. It can also bump into the snake, the serpent, these circulation cycles. And they can be disordered or uncoupled. The Chinese traditional cybernetic medicine, also called traditional Chinese medicine, then understands this coupling and uncoupling, because they're cybernetic. They know about these cycles within cycles within cycles. So then when the bump in the body hits one of these organ system or organ cycles, these cycles need to retune and recalibrate between them. Essentially, that is what Max Planck tried to describe. And when that fails, it falls back on a previous state, because it's not just that the cycles need to calibrate within themselves, but they might have to fall back on this fractal development, that they might have to replicate or recreate that specific cycle group, that specific organ dynamic, by falling back on the other organs. That's what traditional Chinese medicine does, the cybernetic medicine. If one organ system is out of kilter, it looks at the other organs and see where is the frequency attuning going wrong. And so it no longer looks at the cycles, but it looks at the decision trees, the division trees. It looks at the fractal. How far do we need to go back in the fractal? Do we not need to go from the meridian system back to the medical meridians? Do we need to go back to the chakras? Do we need to go back to the four elements? Do we need to go back to the open closed system, the yin and yang? Or do we actually need to reroute it at the source in the point of one, the quantum space, the zero point? So that is then the fourth level of fallback in this equation of health. Essentially, from the apple back to the snake, back to the tree, back to the garden. And then all of that is the interface between us and the unknown. We always navigate in the unknown. But now we have the understanding that the relationship we have with the known and the unknown, we can never bridge this gap, but we can use parallax. We can use a dynamic approach by which we can fuzz out this edge of the unknown. And it's really funny that in the eye you can see that, because in the eye there's this whole retina of the eye. It's a neural plexus. And Edward Land described beautifully, he discovered the Polaroid camera, and he realized that in the eye all of these cells are interconnected in a network. And that's also where you can then see that they can amplify, select and filter, do this whole Moray array computation. And all of that is integrated in the eye, put together in a big bundle which goes into the brain. But there where that retina information, say the radar dish which receives the information, that's where the cable then goes into the brain. That's why we have the blind spot. The other eye has a blind spot as well, but the blind spots are not in the middle, they're at the side. So when you close one eye, you can start to see the blind spot, how you can put your thumb in front of you, and then suddenly you can no longer see your thumb, but you need to really be careful about it, because the fuzzing over technology that has been used in our body to skip seeing the edge of reality is very refined. So the eye, in the system, the blind spot are covered because the one eye covers for the other in the position of the blind spot. And then even if you close one eye, the eye makes a saccadic movement. It moves left and right and left and right. It shivers. It shimmies. But as a result, you have great difficulty to see the edge of that blind spot. It took quite a while before people realized that they had this visual blind spot. It took them even longer to realize that they have mental and spiritual blind spots. But once you see that, then you can see that the saccadic movement of the eyes, then is the second layer of cover-up. Third level of cover-up is that the two nerve bundles go into the brain and then they're sort of tossed around. The one goes to the left, the other goes to the right, and then they're projected onto the same. So again, they sort of error correct for the one and the other. And out of that then comes a final computation, which is what we then seemingly see. So in India, they call that what we seemingly see Maya. It's the interpreted projection of samsara. Samsara is all of these body sensory cells responding to vibrations in the world around us. We know nothing about the world around us for the simple reason that we are not in touch with it. The only thing that connects us to the world around us is the sensory cell array on the surface of our body, like a solar panel, but much more clever. And then from the sensory cell to the nerve, to the neural plexus, to the brain, one-dimensional, two-dimensional, three-dimensional, four-dimensional, we create an interpretation of these vibrations on the surface of the body. And then that interpretation, that image, that hologram, we call Maya. Evidently, that hologram is continuous because the brain is composed of living cells. They process information, they work with atomic nuclear energies. They unfolded from the one cell as a hologram. They are coherent in everything they do. They're phase related. Speed of light doesn't matter to them because everything goes at group velocity. Einstein made the mistake of thinking that the light ray was only the waves in the light beam, and he forgot about the wave envelopes. The brain cells don't forget about that because they originated from this first cell, which divided and replicated as a Cooper pair, had this feed-forward feedback loop between them, unfolded again and again and again. So all of these feed-forward feedback loops are interconnected. And out of that interconnectedness, the wave train, the wave envelope, and the soliton is how the brain functions. So the brain cells are able to compute an image of reality, and contrary to what neurologists said, they do not wait for impulses from the neurons. They wait for phase changes. They wait for changes in the input. So they update their information. They start to do that a bit with television screens. Everything that is the same they keep, and everything that is different they add. A lot less work. Brain cells have even less work because they work with a phase orchestrated hologram. Using isophase factor potentials and all this stuff which traditional cybernetic medicine calls the chi and the meridians. These are all in phase space. And Cyril Smith is one of the people who really got that understanding going for us. So with all of this understanding, that the brain as a whole has an image of, say, the world around us. Actually, the brain in the head is the counterpart and the mirroring of the body. If you look at the body, then essentially you need to understand that the brain was at the core of her body, at the solar plexus, but then the brain has been turned inside out. Jaap van der Waal has helped to understand that. And so that the sensory organs system, the information integration system, which functionally is at the core of the body, has been physically, topologically put at the top of the body, for the simple reason that it's further away from the ground, better protected, has better capacities for remote sensing and all kind of other stuff. But the brain and the body are still connected in a Möbius loop. The brain and the organs are counterparts, mirror images of each other. That is also why the Chinese medicine, they don't have to work with the organs, because they can also work with the brain. And instead of working with the brain, they can also work with the neural and hormonal system. Instead of working with the neural hormonal system, can also work with the sensory system, because again, the vortex, the egg, and the torus, and the universe are actually one and the same. So with that understanding, we can come back to how do we then fill in this gap of ignorance? Same as what we do with the eye, same as what we do with everything, we fuzz it over. But we need to understand, and that's also the core of the science of life, that this edge of reality is not where Einstein put it. Classical science just ignored it. Baby in the cradle is it, that's it. Then the child walks around in a house and discovers other house, cannot go there. Relativity theory learned to limit its axial radius. Quantum mechanics, probability theory, went into puberty and realized, well, actually, I can go into the other house if I can get an invitation. They need to recognize me. They need to understand that we complete each other. Boy, girl is part of the same story, and then suddenly a world opens up for you. Puberty, you learn to go out of your limitations, transcend the limitations, and step out into the outer world. And then an adult is somebody who simply realizes that we have different houses with different conduct and different communication codes all around us. And the more of these keys of conduct that you have, the more you can travel around in that. So classical relativistic, probabilistic, and unified science then had that development. I already said that classical science, basically the baby in the cradle, outsider observer, relativity theory, the child sort of in the household, have a reactor response mode. At puberty, it becomes interactive. That's where Max Planck and probability theory put us. But unified field theory has a integrated understanding, because it realizes that the foundation of the universe is something we cannot see, but it is everywhere. And that is then the creator aspect of being. But once you see that there is this creator aspect of being, then you realize that matter is composed of molecules, molecules composed of atoms, atoms composed of quantum chains, but quantum change is everywhere. The edge of reality is not just this box, this bucket, this balloon, or this bubble at the edge of reality as we can imagine it. But just as in mathematical spaces, at the zero point in the mathematical space can be anywhere. If you go right two steps and you say, okay, now I compute everything as -2, so what was 2 now becomes 0. You can put that zero point everywhere in mathematics, but in the same way, that zero point, that edge of reality, is everywhere. And the key to understanding the science of life is that the quantum change, which is at zero point, which is that pivot point of the vortex, it is everywhere. And then when you create atoms, that vortex is actually the quantum force which will move the atom from one niche in the deuteron set to the other. Tetrionics doesn't have atomic orbits. It has atomic niches. They're very well defined, very specific. You can calculate the distance, you can calculate the positions, you can calculate how much energy you need to go from one to the other. there's no fuzzing over and no saccadic movements of misunderstanding at that level. You know where the electrons can be, and then you simply map out how they can get from one position to the other. But that means that you see the edge of reality everywhere, because if you have a deuteron niche, a deuteron is a proton and a neutron stuck together by strong force bonding with a space between where an electron fits. The electron can be magnetically suspended, rotate there, but the deuteron is fixed in space and time. So when the electron moves, it can go from one orbit, from one deuteron to the other. So it's not an orbit, it's actually a factual, very precise, specific location, but it can move. So when you understand that, then the probability is actually a possibility, and then you can see the electron is there or it is not there. As Schrödinger tried to understand that with the Schrödinger cat, in tetrahedrons you can see actually how it happens. The electron is there or the electron is not there. And then it takes a quantum change to put the electron there or put the electron away from there. So suddenly you can then see that by a quantum change you can make the electron jump, but you can then also make the electron move in a molecule. That means you can also make the molecule get bonded or not in materials. So that is what I call a zipper of manifestation. How the quantum leap can then trigger an electron leap, which can trigger an electron oscillation, which can trigger electron bonding. But the quantum leap is in phase space, nothing material there. The electron leap is in the atoms, only atoms. The electron oscillation or the electron flux is in molecules, very precisely understandable. And then the electron bonding is immaterials, as materials. So from the perspective of tetrionics, you can then see, flip a quantum here, then the electron will jump from one niche to the other, or out or into the atom. That means that there will be a change in the electron current in a molecule, polarity one way, polarity the other way, and so on. But that means that the molecules can now fix or unfix in a material cluster that you're looking at. So then you can see that this quantum change is in the subatomic space, in the atomic space, in the molecular space, or in the material space. And in the science of life, you can then be very precise and know where freedom of choice operates. And all that it requires is that you have bivalent states. You need to have an electron which can be there or not be there. Schrödinger's cat has been resolved. So then you know that that's a place where you can have a freedom of choice activating an atom in a specific way. But if that atom gets activated, then the molecules can get a recalibration on how they function. But that means that the materials can have a recalibration on how they function. So you can see how a freedom of choice is actually the way you can use quantum state change in atoms, in molecules and materials. And then when you look at the body as a whole, you can see that the cells produce proteins, enzymes, hormones and pigments, which means physical, chemical, electromagnetic or photonic interactivity. So the cells can communicate in all of those four domains. So that's the cell communication. And when you look at what the cells produce as biomaterials, they're piezoelectric, they're liquid crystal, they're transistor, and they're intelligent gel. Again, they can fix by having electron cloud dynamics, or they can change fixation by electron currents, or they can change the electron current by the material organization, or they can even materialize and dematerialize on the basis of information. So with all of that, we can now come back to what I already said about Bert Vervain. He realized that we fuzz out this gap of ignorance between us in what he described as the feed forward and feedback between the cells. he described it for the organs, but when you look at where it comes from, you can see that's in the cells. You can see that's a mutuality and reciprocity in the cells. A lot of people don't get there, but in the cell system it is there. So then in the cells you can see that the feed forward and the feed back loop need to connect for health, and that is the foundation, that's the power of the word of Bert Vervain. He now gives a very explicit possibility to define health. Health is the feed-forward feedback continued coherence. As you said at the beginning, if you have a projection without a perception, things can go really wrong. But if you keep on reality testing, then you keep on perceiving while you project your expectation, and you retune your expectation. And that's what the cells do in these feed-forward and feedback loops. But sometimes, I already talked about this equation of health, sometimes you bump into reality and you need to reset things. So sometimes the cells have an overshoot or an undershoot. They have this feed forward and it goes to the other cell, but it's just at the rim, or it can barely reach it or a bit further and it would have lost it. So there is a range of variability in which the feed forward and feedback loop can still connect. And so if you when there is a stable feed forward feedback loop, you call it health. When it goes into this okay, yes, no, okay, we just saved it, that is the domain of adaptation. It can keep on going, but it needs to internally adapt. So it's too much when it comes on one cell, so it needs to add something to have it go back to the other cell, and so on. Third level is where the feed forward and the feedback loop, they overshoot or undershoot. And Bert Vervain understood that very well, and he said then you get diseases of excess and diseases of deficit. There's too much corticosteroid or too little corticosteroid. And so they're both the same disease. So the Cushing and Addison disease in medicine is not two different diseases. It's the same system of corticosteroid, but the loop cycle is not matched. It goes from adaptation to compensation. Something else is needed to keep it going. So you need to have an external corticosteroid or corticosteroid drain to restore the balance. And so that is then the domain of compensation. You need to do something extra. Chinese medicine understands that. They describe that if the loops do not match anymore, you need an extra loop to make them match up again. Actually, in society, you can see how psychopaths and other idiots then play out one against the other to have their desires fulfilled. So they create these extra loops, they build in these extra lies, which in the classical was called the deception of the devil, the cheat, the make-believe, the pretense. So they create false images in the hologram, and then out of that comes this compensation. It is a distortion. Fourth level of this dynamic of the feed-forward or feedback loop is that it just crashes down. It cannot compensate anymore, the whole system breaks down. Feed-forward, feedback loop separate, and the two cells can no longer be in unity, and the system collapses. Unless you can have them reset so that instead of collapsing, they can reboot from inside. And then instead of going from health to adaptation to compensation to decompensation, you go from health to adaptation to compensate to recompensation. It reboots and starts again, and that's where spiritual healing, psychic healing do their stuff. So that essentially brings me to the end of this story. We are living in and with the unknown. It's unavoidable. Actually, the unknown is everywhere. If we take our eyes as an example, the blind spot, we fuzz it over so that we don't see it, but that doesn't make it disappear. Likewise, we have blind spots of ignorance, we have blind spots of denials, we have blind spots of self-deception, We fuss them over, pretend that they're not there, but they interfere with the system. Once you understand how these blind spots work, then you can trace it back to what happens in the origination of the cell out of the cell replication of the first cell, and then you can see that the connection between that what is and what is not always takes place in the that what is not. That's where the religion said it's always God doing it, where Tetrionic says it's always the quantum field doing it, where we can now say we are always in touch with this unknowing. But that's actually a good thing, because this unknowing, as it is everywhere, we're in contact with it everywhere. So God is right by your side, because God is within you, so to say, because the quantum field is within you, but that also means that quantum flip is within you, and that freedom of choice is within you. So that wherever you don't know, you are free to choose. And that, of course, is that step again from classical to relativistic to probabilistic to unified science. The outsider became the reactor, became the interactor, became the creator. So we are creators in creation. Our body is actually the interface between the physical and the metaphysical. It is tangible, but it's at the same time based on everything which is intangible. That was the answer to question number one. So the answer to question number two is we are actually in a half-defined state between the material and the immaterial. We should stop thinking that the material is what it is about, because as Tetrionic says, it originates from the immaterial. It is still interwoven with the immaterial. It is still the immaterial that puts it in place. But in our use of freedom of choice, we are actually participating in that, how the immaterial puts it in place. So as the old religion said, we are gods. This domain is the playground of the gods, so that they can learn to recognize or see themselves and discover that we are all creators in creation, because we can flip the quantum state, because we have freedom of choice. And it is everywhere, and it is specifically everywhere there where you don't know. So maybe I'll just leave it at that, and I'll end the recording here, and then I'll come back to you.
Okay, very good.